Accession number 5204, real one.
Major Blackburn, real one. Could you tell me, first of all, Major Blackburn, which year it was that you joined the army?
1919, originally.
Why did you decide to join?
Well, in those days, all youngsters were hoping that the war would last long enough for us to all get in on the act. I was in the cadet forces at the time, and the war, unfortunately, finished, from my point of view, in November 1918. But I was still so anxious to get into the army that I joined up in February 1919. But I was only 16 years of age. On paper, of course, I was 18, but I was actually 16. Desire to join the army was just that, one wanted to get in on this sort of event that was happening. As youngsters, I'm afraid we didn't realise the other side of war. So, like I say, February 1919, I was 16 and a bit, and in the army.
Which unit did you join?
Originally, Royal Army Medical Corps. And the reason for that was that I wear glasses, and in those days one couldn't get into the infantry or any combatant corps with the weak eyesight. So I was persuaded by the recruiting sergeant that the medical corps would accept me, which they did.
Did you learn to transfer to a different corps?
Yes. After a year in the medicals, which I didn't really enjoy, I realised that the ordnance was a sort of a semi-combatant unit. So I transferred to the ordnance as a storeman. By this time, of course, we were in Germany. I was with the first occupation on the Rhine Army. I transferred to the ordnance at Nippes.
At where?
At a place called Nippes, a suburb of Cologne, NIPPS. And whilst there, I qualified as a Clerk 3B, and I was the ordnance officer's personal typist. Whilst I was there, I noticed that the Middlesex Regiment was stationed at Kelk, and being a Londoner, of course, this interested me. They were always very smartly dressed. It was really a crack regiment, especially in my eyes at that time. So I decided I would apply for a transfer to the Middlesex Regiment. This horrified the ordnance officer because he said that I'd have to do an extra year's service from 6 and 6 to 7 and 5. I would also lose my shilling a day trades pay. But trades pay I didn't bother about. I wanted to get into the infantry, and the Middlesex Regiment was my regiment. So I applied for the transfer, but I didn't take my glasses off at the interview. I felt if I'm going to be accepted, they're going to accept me with glasses, which had been my bugbear. The colonel who interviewed me was a Colonel Wallace Wright, Victoria Cross. And after a few words and why did I want to transfer and so on, he accepted me. And I was accepted into the MIDS, and I carried on with the MIDS then until I finished my reserve service.
Which year was this that you transferred to the Middlesex Regiment?
21. I can't remember the month. Probably be about April, I should think.
You said that you hadn't enjoyed it in the RAMC. Why was that?
Well, I was only 16 and a bit, bear in mind. I knew very little about nursing, and I was posted to a venereal hospital in Scotland. In those days, I hardly knew, well, I didn't really know what sex was. I was too young to appreciate, you know, what it was all about. I was at a place called Stobbs, near Hoyt in Scotland, which was a venereal hospital, and all the patients, of course, were chaps who were coming back from the war, from Egypt and, you know, France and so on. And I was quite horrified about this sort of thing, and having to attend these chaps, I felt nervous about even touching anything, you know. I mean, I had any idea what it was all about, really. All I did, of course, was to make beds and take temperatures and dish out medicine as instructed. And I was very glad to get out of it. And before I transferred, they transferred me back to London, to the 3rd London General Hospital at Wandsworth, which I think in this last war was a place where a lot of interrogation went on for, people who had no countries. But the 3rd London General was a general hospital for wounds, but there was one or two wards for officers who had contracted venereal disease whilst in London. Probably they brought it with them, I don't know. But the female nurses had to dress their wounds, and the male, we had to go in afterwards to give them their treatment for their venereal. And I didn't like working under nurses and sisters. The matron was quite a tyrant. And I was very glad to find out something about the ordnance and get out of it. It stood me in good stead in after years, of course. I mean, I learned a little bit about first aid and how to take a temperature and so on and so forth. So it wasn't entirely wasted.
Now, when did you get a posting to the Far East?
That was in 1927. The battalion, we were at Catterick. There was trouble, of course, in China. There was Chiang Kai-shek, who was supposed to be the communist, against Chen So-ling, who was the Christian general. And there was mayhem, I think, in Canton. They tore the place apart there in the Civil War. And we were rushed out from Catterick to Hong Kong as part of a build-up of British forces. We were only at Hong Kong, I think, about 6 weeks when there was a breakthrough and we had to be rushed up to Shanghai, because at that time I think the fighting was about 30 miles from Shanghai and we were 3 days' sail at Hong Kong. So of course they had to push us up there quickly. It was to protect the settlements, of course, against the fires and the atrocities that were going on up there. It was pretty hairy at the time, because when we landed at Shanghai, we didn't know where we were going. I was a corporal with a section. They rushed us straight off the boat onto trucks. They were council lorries and things, driven by Chinamen. We hadn't a clue where we were going to be taken, and they dumped us. Normally, of course, you always find the troops up in the slummy areas, in the worst areas. And there we were, dumped among a load of barbed wire and a blockhouse. And we didn't really know where we were. And they could have kidnapped the whole Blue Platoon. We wouldn't have known where we were going. And we were stuck there for about 3 weeks without relief, just as we stood up, with a load of ammunition. And it was on the outskirts of Shanghai, at a place called Shapai. Over the wire, of course, each night we could hear shootings and there was burnings and there was fires going on. And there was a curfew, of course. No Chinese were allowed through our barriers, through the wire. Quite exciting.
What was the purpose of you being there exactly?
To prevent them getting into Shanghai. I mean, there's a lot of money in Shanghai. It's a very wealthy place, or it was in those days. There was all the settlements. You had a French settlement, there's a German settlement, and, various settlements. And each settlement had got its own volunteer force. There was the French and the British. But they needed troops to, protect the place.
Who were you trying to prevent getting into Shanghai?
Well, either side, but our so-called enemies were the troops under General Chiang Kai-shek, because he was the one that was doing the advancing. He'd come up from Canton, and they'd fairly well wrecked Canton, and they would have made quite a mess of Shanghai could they have got into the stores and the big shops and places like that.
Did the troops feel that the forces of Chen So-lin were friendly towards the British?
No, I don't think anybody felt they were friendly. We, as far as we were concerned, they were just the other side. They were the enemy, really. We used to see them. You see their sentries on the other side of the wire, about 20 yards from you. But there was no sort of interference with one another.
Whose troops were these sentries that you could see?
They were Chiang Kai-shek's troops. They were supposed to be the communist troops in those days. Subsequently, of course, he became an ally to us this time. It's politics. But he was the enemy. There was a rumour that if we could have caught him, there was a price on his life and we'd have got rewarded. And so, but these are just rumours that go round, you know. Our idea, of course, was to stop them coming in. Frankly, if in hindsight, if they'd really wanted to come in, they could have come in quite easily, because the sampans on the water, as you perhaps know, Shanghai is all water, canals, and we had no control over the water. I think that was left to the local Shanghai police. But had there been a really determined effort, I suppose they could have got through. But we felt in our way that with our training, I suppose, we felt that we could have taken on the old army. You know, you get that sort of feeling with as a regular soldier that nobody could have pushed us out of those dugouts and blockhouses if we didn't want to be pushed out.
So you and the other Middlesex troops were in a kind of base, were you?
Mm.
Can you describe the place that you were in?
Oh, the battalion itself, we were based in various points. On one occasion we were in a school called the Nichikui School. I've got photographs of this at home, really. Then we were in a place at Yangtze Pu. I think they were godowns, you know. They were sort of, I don't know whether they had, I think they must have been cattle godowns, because we had to clean the places out with a lot of cattle muck. They're down near the water's edge. But the battalion itself wasn't always together. You know, there would be a company here and another company somewhere else. We were split up mostly in schools. On another occasion, we were in a big house. I don't know whether it had been a private school, but we overlooked a temple. These chaps used to go around banging gongs all day long. So that I couldn't really say we were on any particular base.
So how many of the Middlesex troops were you personally with when you could see these sentries of Chiang Kai-shek?
Oh, your own section. We had quite some fun, really, at times, because you had to mark up a logbook every half hour or so, situation quiet and so on and so. Each of these blockhouses had a searchlight, a very powerful light, which would shine across the creek onto the other side. The so-called enemy were on the other side of the creek, and we're this side. There's a bridge in between, of course, but that's blocked off. We've got a blockhouse and a searchlight. We were supposed every half an hour to report in the book, everything quiet. On one occasion, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, I had a youngster named Woolnough. He was a young recruit. He'd only joined the battalion straight from the depot to build us up to full strength to go out to China. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, Woolnough came sliding in on his knees almost. It was a low down blockhouse, you know. And he said, "They're firing at me, Corp, they're firing at me." I said, "Who's firing at you? Nobody's firing at you." They're firing at me. So I went out to have a look. His post was about 10 yards from the blockhouse. And I'm standing there at the wire and couldn't see anything, couldn't hear anything. And I said to him, "You've been asleep on your post." "No, I haven't, Corp." I said, "You've been asleep on your post. There's nobody around here firing at anybody." I'd forgotten that I was raising my voice, which carries over water. And the next thing it was ping! Somebody was firing, all right, and this blooming bullet. And I remember grabbing his rifle and saying, "God," and he was saying, "Hey, I told you, Corp, I told you it was right. I told you I was being fired at." Like, "Shut up, keep quiet." So, of course, I turned the section out to stay in by, and we switched this light on suddenly and pivoted it right along the other side of the water. Never saw anybody. But if we had a down, I'm sure we would have fired, because not that we hated the chap, but how dare he fire at one of my sentries? You know, that was the attitude. Blooming cheek. "I'm not going to let you get away with this." Not a soul. I suppose he was a patrolling Cantonese, I suppose they were. And he'd heard, or he knew there was a sentry there, and he put his shot, mind you, the shot went miles away over in the air, but at 3 o'clock in the morning, it's quite something, you know, to have somebody within reach of you to fire.
So was it just a single shot?
It's just the one shot, yeah. Why he should have fired, I don't know. It might have been an accident, but I think he heard my voice. There's no doubt I was talking louder than I should have done across water. And any more trouble.
Those Chiang Kai-shek sentries that you could see, can you describe what they looked like?
Well, they had a sort of a grey uniform. I wish I'd brought my photographs in. It was a very cheap-looking stuff. It was a grey peak cap, the head of a red star, and it was a cloth star. We got two of these hats, actually. Something that never went into the report book, by the way. On one occasion on the bridge, the Soochow Bridge, you can't see the other side of the bridge because it's so high in the middle. And I walked up to the middle of the bridge in the early hours of the morning to look over and see what was on the other side. And within a couple of minutes, either side of me was a couple of Chinese sentries. And I realised I shouldn't have gone as far. I'd gone a little bit too far. And I just said, you know, OK, and put a thumbs up and walked back very slowly. They didn't attempt to stop me. And I related this to a couple of fellas. One chap was named Lines. I always remember him. Lines and Barlow. They were very good section chaps. And a few minutes later, they crept out of the dugout while I wasn't there, or while I was doing something else. And I heard a bit of a noise on the bridge, and they came back with these two hats. They'd set about these two sentries for no reason at all, that they'd interfered with their corporal. Couldn't put that in the report book, because we'd no right to go over there anyway in the first place.
In what way did they set about them?
Well, they just pushed them around and just pulled their hat off and then run back, you see. I think the sentries, because in the dark, there was no lights, nothing, everything was dark. I suppose the sentries were taken just as by surprise as I had been a few minutes earlier. I didn't see these chaps. The bridge had, you know, girders, and they must have been standing behind the girders.
So they got their hats as souvenirs, did they?
And they got their hats as souvenirs, yeah. I took a photograph of them. I could send them in to you to let you see this. But they were very cheap made. I should say, you know, these children that buy conductor's outfits in the shops here, it's a very cheap material. Well, it was something like that. They had pantaloon trousers, a bit baggy round the knee, and puttees. Sort of all grey, it was all a light filled grey. And the red star, it was a cloth star. But we had to hide those because we didn't report that in the first place.
What was the attitude of the Chinese sentries? Were they aggressive or friendly or what?
They weren't friendly. They weren't aggressive. They weren't friendly. They just stood there. They watched us in the same way that we watched them. Curious, I suppose, really. They didn't attempt to come too close to the wire or anything like that.
Did they attempt to speak to you?
No.
Are you to them?
No. We used to try unofficially to get hold of some of their ammunition. This had been put out to us quietly. And you know, in the army, they have wooden bullets for training purposes, you know, for recruits. We used to have a clip of these wooden bullets in the hopes that we could persuade them to give us one of their bullets for 5 of ours, which was a good, you know, we hoped that they would fall for that. I didn't think any of them ever did fall for it, though. The idea was to see who were making the bullets, and, you know, I suppose intelligence wanted that sort of thing.
So you were given instructions to do this, were you?
Well, off the record, we were told that if we could do this, you know, but don't get into trouble doing it, if we could get close enough to them. We used to show them, but they never parted. We used to try and signal one of those for 5 of those sort of thing. But I never heard of anybody. They certainly didn't. I didn't get any.
How long were you in Shanghai altogether?
In Shanghai itself, about 4 months, I think. And from there, we went up to Waiwai.
In Shanghai, whilst you were there, did you see any violence at all?
I didn't see any violence. We had on one occasion to clear a street near the racecourse. Why, I don't know. There was quite a crowd of Chinese people. They weren't troops, they were civilians. And I think the civil authorities must have called on the army for a bit of help. Our company were ordered to clear the crowds from the street. There was a big market there, a vegetable market. And we had cudgels, you know, we were issued with long staves, such as the Sikh police used to have. And our orders were to go in and just, you know, whip up and clear the street. But I didn't see any violence. But Shapai was burned pretty severely. And I managed to get some photographs of the burnings and some of the heads hanging in trees, which I've got at home, which I could have bought in and shown you. We didn't take these pictures, of course, but later on there was a slight lifting. The wire could be opened between certain times when the tension had gone a bit. But we had to pick out and search occasionally, now and again, stop anybody and search them. And you used to get official photographers through there, and we'd stop one of them and they'd perhaps have a wad full of these photographs of heads hanging in trees and butchery in the street and things like that. We're supposed to take those from them, hand them to the civil police, who presumably would, I don't know what they would do with them, but they're for information. You'd perhaps take a dozen pictures. Well, we used to see that we had a couple for ourselves as souvenirs. I've got them at home now, and they cause a bit of comment at times.
When you had to clear the street of the... Were there demonstrators that you were trying to clear?
I suppose they were. I don't really know what they were doing, except that the street was crowded with people. And whether it was a demonstration against cost of living or something, I don't know. I have no idea what it was for, but we just had to help clear this street.
Were they all men or men and women?
Oh, it was men and women. It was all around the market. It looked to me it was probably nothing more than a complaint about the cost of food, bearing in mind that Shanghai was pretty well cut off, you see. I suppose supplies weren't getting in and out. I don't really know what it was for, but we just cleared the street.
Do they have placards?
No, I didn't see any placards. Just a lot of shouting and arm waving and shouting.
Did they seem aggressive towards the troops?
No. We got on very well with them. I like the Chinese, I always did. We got on better with the Chinese than we did our English settlers out there. In Hong Kong particularly, the English people just didn't want to know the British troops. There was quite a lot of trouble there in Hong Kong.
Coming back to the demonstration, how many people would there be in the street that you had to clear away?
Oh, pretty crowded, I suppose. It was a big vegetable market in the middle of the town. Could have been several hundred, I suppose.
And
they didn't attempt to resist us, by the way. When we started yelling, you know, when you get the order to charge, you just yell and make an awful row, wave your sticks. They just vanished. I didn't see anybody actually hit or anything. I think the fact that we were coming for them, they just scattered, dashed into various shops and alleyways and things. They just vanished.
How many of the troops charged?
It was only about half our company, that was all.
How many men would that be?
About 100, I suppose. And you go forward in waves at about 20, and your instruction, well, you go forward, you're supposed to whack them, but if any of them get under your arm and get behind you, don't turn your back on the crowd. Just keep going, because there's another wave behind you to pick up the stragglers that get through. And there might be two or three waves of troops, you know, to follow through.
So you had the sticks?
We just had these lathes, latties, I think they call them. The Sikh policemen used to have them.
Did you have shields?
No.
Did any of the demonstrators get hit?
I didn't hit any. I think the fact that we were charging for them was enough. I didn't see any, what you might call, ill treatment at all.
Did they throw any stones?
No, nothing aggressive towards the British troops at all. I don't really know what the demonstration was all about. It was just the police, for some reason, wanted to clear the street.
Was that the only incident that you saw whilst you were there, of that kind?
Of that kind. It was the only time I ever was mixed up in anything like it.
You mentioned the atrocity photographs that you and the other troops obtained. Mm. Who had committed these atrocities with cutting people's heads off and so on?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it was 6 to 1 and half a dozen the other. I mean, the Chinese have a different outlook on life. I'm talking about the China of 50 years ago. I don't know about the modern China, but in those days, we felt that they got no respect, of course, for life at all. For instance, if anybody fell in the canal, nobody attempted to get them out, because the gods or the spirits had wished them to fall in the canal, and that was it. There was a rumour that if a woman fell in the canal and a British soldier went and pulled her out, he would have to keep her for the rest of his life, because she wouldn't go back to her family. She defied the spirit. You see, I would not say the modern China is the same, but in those days they were cruel to one another, in our eyes anyway.
So the atrocities that had been committed, were they atrocities committed by one set of troops against another set of troops, or against civilians?
I should imagine against civilians of their own, of Chinese civilians, because they would do it with the looting, you see. They would do some butchering. Matter of fact, the photographs I've got, they weren't troops that were being executed, they're civilians that were being executed. But troops were doing it. There was photographs of the troops and with a sword, and some were being shot. Another one I've got is a couple of heads hanging up in trees. I don't know whether they were troops or civilians, but definitely had been decapitated.
So which months of the year were these 4 months that you were in Shanghai?
Oh, dear. I should think from about March, June, up to about July, end of July. It was getting very hot when they moved us out. We were the first British battalion in, and we'd had the roughest end of the deal. And then later on, we were relieved by others. I think there was the Borders and the Durham Light Infantry. Other troops were coming up from India and other places. So they took us out about July when it was getting very hot. And they pushed us up to Wei Hai Wei, which was a naval base, actually. The Navy had the island, but we were on the mainland.
Before we come on to Wei Hai Wei, I'd like to ask you some more about Shanghai. So the months you were there were probably from March to July 1927.
Was
Chiang Kai-shek's troops massacring the communists at this time?
They were supposed to be the communists, General Chiang Kai-shek. They'd come from the south. And Chen Shou-ling was known as the Christian general in those days, and he was supposed to be the loyal, or shall we say the loyal to the Western idea of politics. And General Chiang Kai-shek was a communist, so he was the enemy, really. But it was a civil war between two ideologies.
You said that whilst you were there that the troops found it difficult to get on with the white civilians in Shanghai. In what way?
No, not in Shanghai, in Hong Kong. when we first got to Hong Kong, we were rushed out to Fan Ling. There's a golf course there, which was patronised, of course, by the white people out there. A lot of people work in the banks and Matheson Land, Matheson's, I think they're cotton brokers or something. And our tents were alongside the golf course. We were not allowed on the golf course, obviously. But in our off-duty hours, we used to stand perhaps near a tee, watching the men and women, you know, playing golf. In the local paper, the Hong Kong Gazette or whatever, one week was a letter written by one of the English people saying that couldn't something be done to stop the troops watching them playing golf as it put them off their game. And it was a very nastily worded letter, which somebody in the company answered back. And the following week there was a letter from one of the troops. It was signed by a fellow named Brown, A. Brown. And I was questioned by my company commander because he thought perhaps I'd done it. But I honestly hadn't done it, although I knew the chap who had done it. And he only replied to the effect that we didn't ask to come out here, but